What if I told you that every problem we solve just creates more problems for us to solve? That is actually the case, and that's what I talked to John Timaeus about in this week's interview. And John is, you'll know him maybe on Twitter as Modernity Has Fallen, but he's a software developer, mathematician, who really has also over the last year looked into how we come to know things, epistemology. How do we know what is true? And I thought it was very interesting to talk to someone who has a very good understanding of logic and mathematical proofs and all these things, and was able to show how the more and more complex we get, the harder and harder it is to actually solve the problems, and the more problems we end up creating, and sort of a vicious cycle that modernity has put in front of us, that the more we spread out and get more intricately linked into all these different fields and start playing in these different ideas, we can't foresee all of the consequences of our actions. And so it was just a very interesting discussion, really great conversation with John. And so I'm excited to bring it to you because, and I'm going to let him do most of the talking on that stuff because he knows it a lot better than I do. But I definitely learned a lot, and it opened my eyes to many of the problems that it's been hard to put my finger on why I have trouble with what's going on. And he was able to explain that in a way that made sense to a layman like me. So I really appreciated that. I really appreciated John coming on and sharing his ideas. You can find out more about him on Twitter. You can find him, Modernity Has Fallen. And I'll have links to his website and his Twitter account as well in the show notes, so you can definitely check those out as well. And I also want to remind you before I hop to the interview that you can support the Conversation of Our Generation by going to conversationofourgeneration.com/subscribe. By subscribing there, you get access to any courses that I'm doing, extra premium content, and you get a signed copy of my book sent your way, as well as access to my Discord community, which is popping as well. Lots of good stuff happening there, good conversations going on. And so definitely head over there for just $5 a month. You get all that. You'll get access to future premium content as well. So check that out. And or you can subscribe to keep up with what's going on, see the top conversations that I'm listening to each week by just going to conversationofourgeneration.com/newsletter. Go there. And you can just give me your name and email, and you'll be getting those weekly news rundowns of some of the top conversations for the week. And lastly, if you're listening to this, please leave a rating and review wherever you're listening, because that really helps with me getting this podcast out there to more people. The better ratings, the higher, given that 5-star rating, leaving a quick review lets those algorithms know that this is a podcast worth listening to. So if you could do that, that really helps out with supporting the show in a painless, free, easy way that just takes like 10 seconds. So thank you for supporting, and let's hop on over to the interview. And so today I have John Timaeus on from Modernity Has Fallen. He's on Twitter at Fallen Modernity. He runs the website modernityhasfallen.com and doing a lot of great stuff. But I wanted to welcome you on, John. Thanks for coming on today.
Well, thanks for having me on.
Appreciate it. Yeah. And so for those who do not know, who do not follow your Twitter, who aren't checking in on your website, what are you working on? What are you all about?
Yeah, so I'll just let you know a little bit of my background. I'm a computer scientist by training. So I actually have a PhD in computer science, and I also am a statistician.
Oh,
So
cool.
that's sort of my background is in like maths and sciences. But my sort of passion or my, this is now sort of my side thing is I'm sort of, I guess, becoming like an amateur writer or philosopher, I guess. I'm really concerned with the sort of interplay between sort of the modern world and religion, or between science, reason, and faith. Or, yeah, essentially comparing really the way the modern world is versus how it sort of used to be in a lot of senses. So yeah, I'm mostly concerned with this idea of like, what is true? How can we know it is true? You know, the word for that is epistemology. But yeah, I've been fairly religious most of my life, but it's sort of seen like an upswing, mostly because of what I've started reading. And I realized basically what I've learned in the sciences have sort of informed that. So I'm just hoping I have some sort of unique take that's helpful to other people and trying to write that up and present that to the world.
Yeah. Well, that's great. And I do think that this is an interesting topic, because I think that one of the biggest things that we have a trouble with understanding each other on is that we do have different epistemological systems, right? The more religious, conservative, traditionalist people, I think we understand the more materialist scientists, like we know where those assumptions come from. If you've looked at Aristotle versus, you know, Darwin and Marx, you can see how there's difference in thought there. But if you haven't gone back to those old writings, and you just take the materialist assumptions that our society has, it's hard to understand how there's other ways of knowing things. And so I think what would help is, maybe I kind of touched on it a little bit, but what are kind of the two, but what are the major differences between a traditional epistemology? Like, what was that? How would you define that versus what we have in our modern world today?
Right. So I would say the more traditional frame of knowing what is true, it really comes from, I'd say, like ancient learning in a broad sense, right? So it's founded on either philosophy or religion. And if you look at, you know, everything pre sort of 17th century, I'd say pre-Enlightenment, right? You see a lot of arguments of people deciding what is true based upon, you know, does it conform to a certain set of beliefs that are, you know, taken on faith essentially, or grounded in some sort of philosophical tradition, like Plato's, for example, or Aristotle's. There's a wide range here. I'm speaking very generally, but and then in the more modern era with the Enlightenment, it moved from, you know, tradition and religion being the sort of center of, or really sort of the bedrock for what is true, to science, so basically empiricism and reason, right? So, and by reason, I mean really sort of deductive reasoning. So in the more modern era, and this is where I sort of got into, like you're saying, you know, thinking about the different assumptions. For the longest time, I sort of didn't really examine that. Mm-hmm. And I kind of had two sorts of worldviews almost sort of bouncing around in my head. And it was sort of confusing to me for the longest time, being like a religious person and also being a scientist. I read a series of books, and I kind of ended up in an interesting place. I sort of always took the modern framework as sort of the truth, right, is sort of like the way to examine the truth, rather. You know, we should start with empiricism, looking at the world around us, and then from there use reason to sort of deduce the rest. But there's really some, I'd say, significant flaws with that worldview, or basing your worldview off of those sort of two ways of knowing what's true. And I sort of piece this together over years, but it's sort of come together recently in my mind. But so really, if you look at the modern, so, you know, the modernists would critique the traditionalists and say, well, you're just taking things on faith. You know, you're just assuming scripture or something like that is your place to start. There's also in the modern worldview, there's some assumptions that don't get really brought up, like, you know, empiricism, right? That really we can start with a sense of what is true by looking at what's around us. So I basically am writing a sort of almost an attack on both those fronts, both empiricism and both reason. Critiquing reason sounds sort of bizarre. And by reason, again, I mean like deductive thought, which is what most people mean when they say reason. There's sort of two attacks on that, and then on empiricism also. I've got some critiques of that as well.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to dive into those. I did want to circle back because I think that that's some, you brought up an important point that I think today we don't recognize that we're taking on axioms. We don't recognize the fact that we are taking on faith that all that exists is material, material things. That they're, because if we're, you can have the argument at the ontological level of, okay, what is there a God? And, you know, look at the sort of philosophical proofs, the rational, you know, using reason in a sort, in a way to say, is it logical to believe in God? And then from there, that, I mean, that's what, how we, I mean, that's how the Greeks were. They, that's how the ancient Israelites and Christianity, you know, it's not that, oh, this book dropped out of the sky and we believe it on faith. It's, we reason to the fact that there has to be a cause of all that is, and we believe that cause is God, because there has to be a cause of a different order and a different kind than all the other causes we see, because every other cause that there is dependent upon another cause. There has to be something that is not dependent on other things and of a different order and magnitude. And so from there, you know, that rationality then takes us to the unfolding of all the other stuff. But we, you know, not every single person can articulate the ontological proofs for God, but you then have this framework from which all these people can spring forward. And if you look at today, we have this axiom that all that exists is material, and also that, you know, you kind of have the Darwinist, you know, evolutionary application to everything. And those two things, the idea of progress and materialism, seem to be axioms that even religious people a lot of times don't recognize that they're taking on as an axiom in their worldview. And I think that that's something to point, just to point out, because it's not like today we know why we believe because it's empirical. It's like, no, we're taking on faith that everything is empirical, and that's how we built our society from that. Whereas before, we took on, you know, we had a logical reason to believe that there was a supernatural order to things that gave us, and then we built a worldview on top of that. But I am curious as well to hear some of your criticisms of sort of that modern system of what is wrong with reason, because I just wanted to call that out because I think you were getting to that, but I just I didn't want to make it sound like, oh, back before, you know, modernity, we just had faith. It kind of sounded like you had made a comment that kind of sounded like that, but I don't think that's your position. So I wanted to clear that up, because I mean, even if you look at Descartes, you know, Meditations on First Philosophy, he doubts all the things that we take as our axioms of materialism. He says the only thing that I can know is real is that I'm thinking, and that there has to be a God that gives me this ability to think, and all the other things around me I have to doubt until he gets to the end of it. And so really, to him, what's more real is God than what is, you know, the things that you can touch and taste, because you have a lot of reason to doubt those even. So I think that our modern skepticism allows us to cast doubt on what's old, but we don't seem to cast doubt on the new things because of our axioms of progress and idealism. But go ahead. So if you want to go ahead and kind of maybe talk a little bit more about some of those problems that you have with our modern embodiment of what reason is and how we think about that.
Right. So it really, and this is what you're sort of talking about, is there's, as I see it now, there's only, there's really two places to start when it comes to, you know, where does sort of reality begin? Is it in the things that we can see and touch, right, around us, the empirical, or is it in the world of, essentially the world of ideas and spirit, right? So it's like Plato versus Aristotle, essentially. And in the modern era, we're sort of 100% on Aristotle's side of, well, we can see and touch things. That's sort of our ground truth. So we have this view that, well, if since we're going to start there with we can see and touch around us and sort of infer sort of the laws of the universe from that, right? So that's sort of very scientific views that we have essentially these two components, that there's a mathematical sort of model for reality that scientists are building in one way or another. So if it's a physicist, they have different models for the mechanics of the universe, etc. Sociologists will also have models for human behavior, often grounded in mathematics or at least logic. And then sort of the empirical world on the other side. So they're trying to basically infer from what they observe, build this sort of model of reality. There's really sort of two problems with this, at least. The idea is once we have this sort of mathematical model of reality, people really start to think of what is true, what is real, in terms of almost a cosmic machine. So you kind of get that sense for a lot of modern, materialists, right?
Mm-hmm.
They end up falling into this very strong sense of, like the will, human beings are also just sort of this cog in this sort of grand machine, right? And it comes from this thought that, we can sort of explain everything sort of precisely, mathematically, logically. And if we just sort of know the right sort of axioms, the right initial assumptions, if we sort of discover those or start with the right ones, we can sort of infer everything that's true. But there's, I'll just get to it. The problem with reason itself is there's two big problems. One is computational. So what I mean by this, if you sort of think about all logical reasoning, every sort of deductive form of deductive reasoning, you're starting with axioms, right? They're really applying some sort of rule to these axioms to infer new facts or theorems, let's call them. And then from those theorems, you'd apply more rules and so on and so forth to come up with some conclusions. So the classic is like modus ponens is what this is the original example. So it's mm-hmm. Socrates is a man. All men are mortal, therefore Socrates is mortal, right? Mm-hmm. That's the same idea of we're starting with a few axioms, we're applying these rules, we come up with conclusions. Well, the issue here is you might think, so early in the 20th century, when computers started to be developed, they started to think, well, can we just have computers do this for us? Could we just put into the system the right sort of ground, assumptions, the right rules, and just let it run and sort of come up with everything that's true. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of effort among people like David Hilbert, who's sort of famous, but maybe to the popular mind, more obscure mm-hmm. mathematician. They're really trying to systemize mathematics into a handful of initial assumptions, maybe about a dozen. It depends on whose sort of set you pick.
Mm-hmm.
And then you could just, from there, sort of everything that's basically mathematically and logically true could be deduced from that. So the first issue with that sort of framework of having this set of principles, like I say, is computational. So you have, you have to sort of imagine it as almost like a tree. Right, where you have maybe your kind of set of original principles, you have a wide variety of rules you can come up with more conclusions from. So it starts to branch. So if you have a choice of which rule to apply, those lead to more and more conclusions. And as that branches out, you end up with an exponential increase. So it keeps effectively, maybe doubling or something like this. Where the more you reason, the more facts you have now to consider because you have more theorems, mm-hmm. right? And it just turns out, from a computer science standpoint, even a modern machine, it becomes practically intractable. So basically, you could put in the right facts, you can put in the right rules, and you can press go. You have the program that works, and it works perfectly. You literally just don't have time to deduce all the right answers. And it depends. Yeah. So in general.
And there's also the limit of human ability. Like when we look at computer models about global warming or the pandemic, it's like we have all these facts and figures. So which ones we don't have the ability to actually know all the pertinent facts and figures to put into a computer model. Even if we did have the computing power to maybe run this simulation, we don't actually know what to tell it either, because we have so much information in so many disparate places.
Yeah, that's also true. But even if we sort of knew where to start, like if we had a, you know, if it was literally given to you by God, the right sort of starting principles and the right rules to apply, and you encoded this in a machine and hit go, you would still just, you'd be waiting forever. So it'd be, you know, the computer would be running, you know, the sun would burn out, humanity would be gone. The computer would still be running, you know, trying to come up with all the answers.
Well, and so it's because it's trying to process an infinite amount of information with a finite amount of power, basically.
It doesn't even have to be close to the infinite for it to break down. It turns out, like, this is something I'm trying to work on articulating better, but sort of an analogous problem is the idea of a salesman going from town to town to town and ending up back where he started. So it's this famous problem in computer science called the traveling salesman. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't sound that bad. If you have like a list of, you know, 10 cities and you want to visit each one once and end up back in the city you started with, and then your goal is to find the cheapest way to walk through each city and end up back in the beginning. So you want to minimize, you know, the distance you travel or the amount you spend on gas or whatever. That turns out to be a problem that it takes an exponential amount of time in the number of cities. So if each time you add another city to it, the time effectively doubles. So you can solve the problem for, you know, up to 20, 100, something like this. But if you wanted to do it, say, for every city on Earth, or every town, village, city on Earth, that's just too much, because it's, you know, it's 2 to 5 million or something like that. So that's the idea, that basically there are these problems we can solve logically on a small scale. But as it starts to ramp up, and you don't have to get that high before you just run out of steam, like it, and even with computers getting faster and faster each year, basically the rate which they improve does not catch up with how hard the problem gets. Right? I add one more, so it's the same,
because they're doubling in, you know, computing power every 6 months or whatever Moore's law is, but at the same time, you know, the demand for what a computer can do is quadrupling maybe every 6 months.
So exactly. It's something like that, where it's sort of, you know, both runners are running faster and faster, but the problem is sort of outpacing the advance of the machine.
Okay.
So that's like the sort of really practical, and that's, I don't see there's any way around this. And I've spent a lot of time as a computer scientist coding. Like there's just certain, it's kind of strange. You might think there's every problem you could just, if you just could code it up, you could hit the button and say go, but it's not true. So even if you had the sort of, you know, God gave you the program and the axioms and hit go, you still would run out of time. That's sort of like the practical limitation. And even quantum computing is not going to fix this. So you can't even appeal to that. It gets you a little bit more, but it's not enough. On the other end, the theoretic end, so if you go back to the mathematics, and that's now, like I was saying, with Hilbert and others, like Brand also, Bertrand Russell, excuse me, was also involved in this. But anyhow, even from a purely theoretic side, there's this idea of, okay, we have enough, right, you know, axioms to start with, you know, logically, mathematically, and if we apply so rules would be, you know, basically proving new theorems. So if you combine the right facts, you can come up with a new theorem. So that's, you know, if you start with 3 points that are not on a line, you can sort of prove that's a triangle. If you, for example, in geometry, right? So if you've taken geometry, is probably the most accessible example of this, that you have about 4 different axioms. And from there, you can sort of prove these other theorems. And you can keep going. Well, you might think if you had the right axioms there and the sort of logical mathematical framework that you could you know, maybe if you had, you know, God's computer, you could get to the right answer. Maybe that's not the right thing to say. I don't want to be heretical, but if you had a, you know, some ultimate supercomputer or enough mathematicians or infinite time or something, you could sit down and think through everything and get to all the right conclusions. There's this mathematician named Gödel who came up with this sort of ingenious proof where he represented that idea of the system of mathematics within a system of mathematics. So he sort of corresponded theorems, so things you're trying to prove to essentially numbers, like prime numbers, and then made proofs in the sort of second system, which is really sort of this metaphor for the first, and they prove that there's essentially truth that you can never reach. So it's a proof by contradiction, but it basically, in my mind, conclusively states that there's, from a theoretic point of view, even if you had the right principles, you have the right rules, there's still things you cannot reason to. Mm-hmm. And as soon as you start dealing with numbers, it breaks down, basically.
Yep.
And the metaphor for this, I was thinking of like a reasonable metaphor. It's like if you had, you know, if you're familiar, if your kid played with Legos, right? If you had just that 1x1 square, if that was your only piece, it didn't, you could only build sort of a stack, right? You could just put one on the end of the other and make this sort of long stack. But if you had like a 2x1, right, you can sort of lay them out like bricks, sort of in that Tetris zigzag shape. So you could build then almost like you could build a wall, you could build a like a perimeter, right? So just the fact that you have a new piece allows you to get to more things you could build, right? So that was like really the question is like, well, what are the fundamental axioms we need to be able to, you know, build everything? So it's like, what pieces do we need to be able to build everything you could build with Legos? But it just turns out it doesn't matter what you start with, there's always going to be something you cannot reach. And even if you, he starts to say, well, even if you take that thing that you couldn't reach and make that an axiom and do it again, there's still something left out.
Yeah.
So it goes on forever. Another
level. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. You just go up to another level and there's always something out of reach. And there's also, going back to the world of computer science, there's also, it's called the polynomial hierarchy. When I was talking about problems we couldn't sort of solve, there's actually levels of that. And like logic is in the first level of things that are sort of intractable, but there's many things sort of beyond that even. So a good example of that might be anytime you're playing a game, like, you know, if a board game like chess or something like this, where if you wanted to know the exact answer, like what's the optimal way for me to play to win, when you were in that I take a turn, you take a turn scenario of, okay, I need to now consider everything you're going to do in response to everything I could do. And that sort of repeats on and on and on until the end of the game. That's actually in a much higher up difficulty level than even just deductive reasoning. So there's that's just another example of something that's in a higher up tier, that it's like, even if somehow we could break through to being able to be perfectly logical as far as deductive reasoning is concerned, there's still tiers beyond that. So it's yeah, there's basically, from the theoretic standpoint and from a practical standpoint, there's just a lot of things we can't reason to, even if we're starting in the right place.
Well, you made me feel better about not being very good at chess, despite the fact that I'm pretty good at like the at the philosophical level, walking through ideas, but being able to understand the other person's like their potential moves and see all those things. I watched the Queen's Gambit and I was like, I don't understand how people can actually do this well. Like, it's crazy.
Yeah. So that, and that's just why it's mentally hard, because you're actually considering a huge range of possibilities, right? And it's sort of branching rapidly. For each move you could make, you know, if you have 10 options, they might have 10 counter options, and off of that there might be another 10. So it's going up by 10 each time, right? So it's not, that's why it's mentally difficult for you or me or anybody, because really you're trying to process a massive number of possibilities. I have a good friend I play board games with, and he's trying to solve these impossible problems basically in his head. I'm trying to tell him like, stop, you can't
you have can't
power and you're wasting our time, like so yeah, that's one, that's basically the idea that we have this mechanical reality. If we just knew about, you know, the basic, the fundamentals of how it works, if we had a theory of everything, you still wouldn't be able to sort of project ahead into the future and tell, know what's going to happen.
Mm-hmm. Right? So, and I think you can just see this, you know, I actually like the Aristotelian way of kind of walking through logic from that sort of, you just see observe things around you and you kind of pull out principles. But, you know, just from like a layman's perspective, as someone who doesn't, you know, I've worked in and around tech, but it just seems like, you know, whenever, if we look at the problems that we were trying to solve 500 years ago, the problems were much simpler. And as we solve each of these problems, we create new ones, right? We solve all of these issues, but, you know, we figure out how to grow enough food, but we don't know how to grow it and actually get it to people now. And then we figure out how to do kind of that, but there's still issues with that. And then also at the same time we're doing this, we have too many fat people now because, you know, we have a problem with obesity because the food is actually not getting distributed in a way that's feeding people. And we also have all these other health issues because what we did to solve the hunger problem is grow a bunch of stuff that's actually not good for us. We solved our caloric issues, but we have all these other problems. And so the complexity of the world just shows that every time we solve something, we don't see all the other potential effects of our solution. We don't see the downsides. And you can't necessarily predict all those, as you've mentioned. We can't possibly know that. We're just trying to solve, you know, make sure that people aren't starving, but we don't realize how many other catastrophic effects could come from solving an issue. Right. And so you can really just see this played out.
Right. Exactly. So this is also my sort of argument against these futurists to think, oh, we're making progress, humanity's on this inevitable rise. What they don't, I think, is possible is that, like you're saying, we've solved easier problems, but the newer problems we're getting, you know, faced with are increasingly complex and more difficult. So I heard like Elon Musk say, like, oh, if you even assume, you know, 1% of improvement each year, if you play into the future, you know, we're going to be, you know, I don't know, living across the galaxy or something like this. But they're not really taking into account that the challenges we're facing are getting harder too. So we're becoming more able, but the problems are becoming more difficult also. So it's, you can't really assume this sort of constant rate of improvement. But if I might just criticize empiricism really quick too, because I think we're running out of time. But so if the modern worldview is based upon this, you know, supremacy of reason and empiricism, you know, science, the critique of empiricism or science, this is really coming from Nassim Nicholas Taleb and the Black Swan, but it really comes from Plato, is that this idea that what you observe essentially is data, and that doesn't necessarily predict the future, is sort of the heart of the problem. So the Taleb's really good illustration of this is the turkey problem. So if you're a turkey living on a farm, and every day the farmer brings you food, you're happy, you're well fed, you're living with your turkey friends, everything's good. If you looked at your life, you know, sort of plotted over time, it's kind of moving sort of up and to the right, things are getting better. But then after, you know, let's say 500 days, the farmer comes out and makes you into Thanksgiving, right? So from the turkey's point of view, their experience points in one direction, that living on the farm is a great situation, but the reality is exactly in the opposite direction. And so essentially its experience, the data has access, this empirical world is sort of a lie. So we, like you were saying earlier on, that we just sort of take the materialist sort of frame and assumptions by assuming what you see around you is the ground or the ground truth, or the, let's say, the basis for what is true. You're missing a lot. Like that's not really accurate. Sometimes the truth is kind of yet to be revealed. Right. So this is also just the turkey problem is basically a restatement in a lot of ways of Plato's allegory of the cave. You know, if someone's in a cave their whole life looking at shadows on the wall from some puppeteer, would they know anything about the outside world? What would it be like if they walked out of the cave? Right. It's just a restatement of that idea that there's really two ways, as I was saying earlier, there's really two ways to start. You can start with the empirical world, or you can start in the world of ideas. So I'm sort of more on the latter, right? Because there's problems with starting in the world of empiricism that what Taleb says is a black swan when the turkey's made in the Thanksgiving, you know, that's another word for this mathematically is non-linearity. You know, you look at the charts going up and up in one direction and suddenly it pivots. That idea that your senses are lying to you, just like, you know, the guy in the cave, this happens all the time. So you could argue 2020, you know, this whole year, last year was essentially a black swan, something no one saw coming. The 08 financial crisis, you know, the 9/11 terrorist attacks, the invention of the computer, the invention of the internet, World War One. This is just like in relatively recent history, right? So you can imagine yourself, I like to think in 1914, like Austria, they must have thought they're at the top of the world, right? How sort of advanced they were. And literally the next year was hell on earth.
Yeah.
So just that sharp departure from their experience to the truth is a black swan. And it can be good and it can be bad. But the I think the bad examples are a little more poignant. But it really sort of undercuts the idea that you can simply know it's true by looking at what's around you.
Yep.
Because the world isn't as predictable as an empiricist would like to claim. Essentially, we can use science in some cases when we have a pattern that repeats itself pretty consistently. Like a good example might be, you know, the beat of your heart, right? You only have to listen for so long to sort of pick up the rhythm and pattern and beats per minute, et cetera. That's,
and it's always also contingent too. That's the other thing that people forget is that science is contingent on, you know, there were only white swans until we went to Australia and found out, oh, there are black swans. I mean, that's where that comes from is, you know, every swan that we saw for millennia was white. And so we assume that, and that's safe, right? That's a safe assumption. But then you get out into the world and you say, oh, that's not the case. You know, if you told someone who lives on the equator that you can walk on water, they'd say, yeah, right. But if you told that to an Eskimo, they'd be like, well, yeah, every winter.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I do it all winter long. So it's there is a bit, and that's why I do like the Aristotelian approach to that, because he does use the data, but then he also then applies, okay, experiential understanding to this as well, and say, I do not have all the facts. I can try to take ideas and experiences that I have and work that into, you know, greater ideas and laws. You know, that's how you get many of the ontological proofs of God, right? That's how you get, oh, we know we have this experience of good, you know, bad, better, worse. So there has to be, you know, perfect. If we have that sort of sliding scale, there has to be something there that's moving towards. You know, you can have those sorts of ideas that you pull from, but you can't just say it. You kind of have to live between the two extremes of, I don't set my water glass down on tables because I can't know whether or not tables are there. And the other extreme of, the only thing that's real is that, you know, this table right here that I'm touching right now, and seeing and can knock on and hear.
Right.
You need, there has to be a little bit of distrust of the senses, but also you have to put your faith in some of your observations around the world and know that they're contingent at the same time.
Yeah. So I guess my point of view, and I just, it's now been about a year, read this book called The Cave and the Light by Arthur Herman. And he makes the case that every philosophy is just the descendant of Plato or Aristotle, right? So you're grounded in empiricism, or you're grounded in the world of ideas, you know, and really the tension is what is important. So I agree that you need to have both sense, some sort of trust in what you're seeing around you, but you also need to have some distrust as well. And you need to have some trust in the sort of the world of ideas and spirit. And you also need to have some distrust too.
It doesn't surprise me that as a mathematician, you're more of a Platonist.
Yeah. I'm probably 60-40 towards Platonism versus Aristotelianism, or however you want to say that. But I kind of lean that way, and I think that's just like my natural bias. But so you need to have some grounding in reality, because that's how you get off in these weird areas of bizarre superstitions, cults, delusional beliefs, you know, the communists, all sorts of weird stuff where fundamentally when it hits reality, physical reality, it just falls apart.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other extreme of like the materialists, they have grounded in physical reality, but they can't begin to explain sort of the deeper truth behind the world, right? They're kind of stuck in the now with no inspiration for the future or what really could be. And I'm also missing sort of half of reality. Mm-hmm. So I think that to me, I would maybe deeply, I'm just a contrarian. And I think we're living more in the age of empiricism. So I pull back towards idealism. But maybe if I lived in a different age, I might be on the other side. But I think that balance is necessary. And I think you can make the case from like a religious point of view, you can see sort of both in scripture and traditional belief. Mm-hmm. But I think the balance to them, to both views is correct. Like, I think that's the real, where the truth is.
Mm-hmm. Great. Yeah. Yeah. I like that a lot. I think I'll have to have you back on to talk more about, we'll do some Plato versus Aristotle maybe next time, because I'm curious to discuss that, but I want to give you a chance because I have to run. Where can people find out more about what you're doing? You know, what are you up to and all that stuff?
My site, modernityhasfallen.com. I just write essays there. I'm kind of rewriting them. I'm really new to this. Like I said, I'm more of a mathematician, computer scientist. I'm new to the world of writing and whatnot. So I'm trying to improve that. So that's there. Also, I'm on Twitter, Fallen Modernity. Mm-hmm. Technically, I'm Gab and Parler too, but I don't use those as much. I'm trying to reach new people rather than talk to necessarily just people who agree with me all the time. So, but yeah, so those two places. I'm also going to put my stuff on Substack too at some point.
Great. Well, let me know when you do, and I'll make sure to throw the link back in the show notes. But those links will be in the show notes for anyone listening. And I really appreciate you coming on today, John, to talk to me. This was definitely very interesting. I think you opened my mind to some of the problems that I hadn't seen. So now I have more problems to solve, I guess, is what you're saying.
That's good. That's what I'm trying to do. Maybe very early on in our conversation sort of alluded to this, like really, I think everyone's worldview is grounded in faith. Essentially. Mm-hmm. So I think we're all religious. So I'll just leave you with that idea.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I'm trying to spread confusion in some sense also.
Great.
Gives you more to think about.
Well, great. Well, thanks, John, for coming on today. I really appreciate it.
Yeah. Well, thanks for having me.
I don't know about you, but that conversation absolutely blew me away. It was just really incredible, honestly. So definitely check out what John is working on with Modernity Has Fallen on Twitter, and all of that links to will be in the show notes for you to check that stuff out as well. And definitely leave a rating and review wherever you're listening to the podcast right now, as well as head on over to conversationofourgeneration.com/courses to check out some of the courses that are available right now. And you can also, while you're there, go to the store, conversationofourgeneration.com/store, and you can buy my book there as well. So if you want to not necessarily be able to support me without not necessarily supporting Amazon at the same time, you can buy those books straight through me, and that helps support the work I'm doing. But I hope you enjoyed this conversation, because I know I did. And for more, definitely head over to conversationofourgeneration.com/blog to see more, or subscribe to the podcast so that you don't miss an episode. And thank you for listening to this episode of the Conversation of Our Generation. Let's get the dialogue going. I'll talk to you next time.